A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the Standards Institution of Israel, the SII, and whether it's a hidden driver of the country's eye-watering cost of living. The core argument is that a country of under 10 million people maintaining its own standards for thousands of product categories instead of just recognizing European standards creates an expensive bottleneck. Three questions. How common is it for allied countries to run their own standards? Bodies, what kinds of standards are we actually talking about? And how would adopting EU standards work in practice based on how other countries have done it? This is basically a standards war playing out in toaster prices.
In car seats and PVC pipes and electrical plugs. The toaster is the emotional core of this debate, honestly. A toaster that costs $30 more in Tel Aviv than in Berlin is not an accident. It's policy. Think about what that actually means in someone's weekly shop. You're not just paying more for one appliance. You're paying a surcharge on every electrical item in your home, every plumbing fixture, every child safety product. It's a tax that doesn't show up on any government balance sheet.
The glockenspiel of regulatory overreach.
I'd say it's more the muzak of trade barriers. Constant, barely noticed, shaping the whole atmosphere. But here's why this matters right now. In May 2026, the Knesset is debating a regulatory reform bill, bill number P/25/4567, that would mandate automatic recognition of European standards for over 200 product categories. This is reigniting a decades-old fight between consumer advocates who want lower prices, local manufacturers who've built businesses around Israeli-specific standards, and the Standards Institution itself, which employs hundreds of people and has existed since before the State of Israel.
1923. The SII predates the country by 25 years. That alone tells you how embedded it is. You're not just reforming a regulator, you're reforming an institution that was setting standards for the Yishuv when the British mandate was still running the show. That's a century of institutional memory and institutional interests.
So what is it? The Standards Institution of Israel is a quasi-governmental non-profit corporation. It certifies everything from toys to tires, food packaging to concrete mix, electrical appliances to children's playground equipment. For many product categories, SII certification is mandatory. You cannot sell the product in Israel without it. And here's the paradox at the heart of this whole discussion. Israel has about 9.8 million people and maintains its own standards for over 3,000 product categories. The European Union has 450 million people across 27 countries and manages harmonized standards through a system called CEN and CENELEC. Why duplicate all that effort for a market 1/50th the size?
That's the tension. And the counterargument from the SII's defenders is that Israel has unique needs. Climate. Voltage, safety culture, language, that European standards don't address. So let's unpack this systematically. First question, how common is it for countries in alliances like the OECD or the EU orbit to maintain their own standards bodies? Is Israel an outlier or the norm?
It is absolutely the norm. Of the 38 OECD member countries, 36 have their own national standards body, NNSB. The only two that have fully delegated to EU-level standards are Luxembourg and Estonia. Everyone else runs their own shop. Germany has DION, the Deutsches Institut für Normung. France has AFNOR. The UK has BSI, the British Standards Institution, which is actually the oldest national standards body in the world, founded in 1901. Even tiny Iceland, with a population of under 400,000, maintains Icelandic Standards, or IST.
Israel having its own body is not weird at all. If anything, it would be weird if it didn't.
Not even slightly. What is unusual is the degree of independence and the low rate of harmonization with international standards. Most of those OECD countries operate within a framework of mutual recognition, especially in Europe. Here's how it works. There are three European standards organizations, CEN for general standards, CENELEC for electrotechnical standards, and ETSI for telecommunications. Together they produce what are called EN norms, European norms. When an EN standard is approved, every EU member state is legally obligated to adopt it as their national standard and withdraw any conflicting national standard. You don't get to keep your own version.
Non-EU countries can participate too.
Countries like Switzerland, Norway, and Turkey are what's called affiliated members of CEN and CENELEC. They get a seat at the table, they can vote on standards, but they don't have veto power. And here's where Israel sits. Israel has held what's called partner status with CEN and CENELEC since 2008. That means it can adopt European standards voluntarily, but is under no obligation to do so. As of May 2026, Israel has adopted roughly 1,200 of the 22,000 plus EN standards. That's about 5%. Compare that to Turkey, an EU candidate country. By 2020, Turkey had adopted 95% of EN standards as part of its customs union agreement. Swiss standards body SNV, about 85% of Swiss standards are identical to EN standards. Norway and Iceland are in the same range. Israel is the outlier, not in having a standards body, but in how little it aligns with the dominant international standards in its trading region.
The question becomes what the SII is actually doing with the other 95% of those standards. And this is where we get into what kinds of standards we're talking about. The prompt asks what typically falls under a national body's purview. Is it just industrial components, or does it hit consumer goods directly?
It hits everything. Standards bodies typically cover a spectrum. At one end, you've got fundamental measurement standards. What is a kilogram? What is a meter? What is a volt? Those are handled internationally through bodies like the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. Nobody argues about those. Then you've got industrial and engineering standards. The tensile strength of steel rebar, the thread pitch on bolts, the fire resistance rating of drywall. These are where ISO and IEC standards dominate, and most countries harmonize heavily.
Nobody's getting emotional about bolt threads.
Some engineers do, but they're a niche audience. Then you've got the third category, consumer product standards. This is where the SII's mandatory certification has the biggest impact on household budgets. Electrical appliances, children's products, food contact materials, plumbing fixtures, construction materials for residential use. If you want to sell a toaster, a car seat, a PVC pipe, or a light switch in Israel, you need SII certification. And if that certification requires testing to a unique Israeli standard rather than a recognized European one, you've just added cost.
Let's make this concrete. Walk me through the electrical plug situation. I think this is the example that makes the whole issue visceral for people.
Israel uses a unique 3-pin plug standard called SI32. It is not compatible with the European Schuko plug, not compatible with the UK's BS1363, not compatible with anything else in the world. It was designed in the 1950s and it works fine. It's not unsafe. But every single appliance imported into Israel either has to be manufactured with an Israeli-specific plug or sold with a detachable power cord that gets swapped at the port. That adds somewhere between $2 and $5 per unit. On a $20 toaster, that's a 10 to 25% surcharge just for the plug. On a washing machine, the absolute cost is higher because you're rewiring a high current appliance. And here's the thing, it's not just the cost of the plug itself. It's the fact that you now need a separate production run, separate packaging, separate inventory management. The logistical overhead often exceeds the component cost.
The counter-argument from the SII is what? That the Israeli plug is safer.
There is no evidence that SI32 is safer than the European Schuko standard. The Schuko plug has recessed pins, it's grounded, it's rated for the same voltages and currents. It's used by over 300 million Europeans without safety issues. The Israeli standard isn't safer, it's just different. And that difference functions as what trade economists call a non-tariff barrier.
Standards as non-tariff barriers. That's the phrase to hang on to. It's the quiet cousin of the tariff. Less visible, harder to quantify, but often more effective at keeping foreign products out.
It's the core economic mechanism here. When the SII maintains its own standard for, say, PVC pipes, every Israeli manufacturer has to pay for local certification. The average cost is between $5,000 and $15,000 per product family. If that manufacturer also wants to export to Europe, they pay again for CE marking. Dual certification adds 8 to 15% to product costs, and that gets passed directly to consumers. For imported products, the same dynamic applies in reverse. European manufacturers face an additional certification hurdle to enter the Israeli market, and many simply don't bother. They run the numbers and conclude that the Israeli market isn't worth the compliance cost.
Which brings us to the car seat example. This one seems to crystallize the real-world consequences.
This is the one that makes me genuinely angry. Israeli standard SI-562 for children's car seats requires a specific tether anchor design that is not used anywhere in Europe. European car seats use ISOFIX anchors, which are an international standard. To sell in Israel, European manufacturers would need to redesign their seats with a completely different anchor mechanism for a market of 9.8 million people. Most of them look at that math and walk away. Only three brands compete in the Israeli car seat market versus over 20 in comparable European markets. Prices are 40% higher.
For a safety product for children. So you're a parent in Tel Aviv. You walk into a store, and instead of having 20 options at competitive prices, you've got three options at a 40% markup. And if none of those three fits your car or your budget, too bad.
This is not about safety. The European ISOFIX standard has been tested across hundreds of millions of units. It performs excellently in crash tests. The Israeli-specific tether requirement does not produce measurably safer outcomes. It just produces less competition and higher prices. If anything, you could argue it reduces safety because some families might delay purchasing a car seat or buy a used one that's past its expiry date because new ones are prohibitively expensive. The safety argument cuts both ways.
We've established that Israel is normal in having a standards body, but an outlier in how little it harmonizes. The real question is the third one. Assuming there would be efficiencies from recognizing EU standards, how would transposition actually work in practice? What does the process look like?
Let's walk through it step by step, because this is where the abstract debate hits reality. When a country like Israel decides to adopt a European standard, here's what happens. Step 1. The SII's relevant technical committee reviews the EN standard in full. These committees include representatives from industry, government, consumer groups, and academia. They compare it to the existing Israeli standard and identify gaps. Step 2. A public comment period, typically 60 to 90 days, where manufacturers, importers, and the public can raise concerns. Step 3. The committee votes. Step 4, if approved, the standard is published as an Israeli standard with a prefix, so EN 1441 becomes SI 1441 Part 1. The standard is translated into Hebrew, and local references are adapted: voltage specifications, climate conditions, seismic requirements for construction.
That translation step sounds trivial. It is not trivial. I want to pause on this because I think people hear translation and think it's just running a document through Google Translate.
It is absolutely not trivial. Technical standards are dense documents, often hundreds of pages. Accurate translation requires subject matter expertise in both the technical domain and the relevant legal terminology. A single mistranslated tolerance in a concrete standard could create liability for every construction project in the country. We're talking about specifications where a misplaced decimal point could mean the difference between a building standing up in an earthquake and collapsing. The SII argues, with some justification, that this takes time and expertise that can't be rushed. But the counterargument is that Switzerland manages this for 85% of EN standards with a population of 8.7 million and a standards body that is largely a translation and publishing operation. The Swiss have figured out how to do this efficiently. The question is, why Israel hasn't?
Then there's the grandfathering problem. I suspect this is where a lot of the political resistance actually lives. Not in the principle of harmonization, but in the messiness of the transition.
This is the hidden cost that nobody talks about in the political debate. When you adopt a new standard, you don't just flip a switch. Existing products that were certified under the old Israeli standard get a transition period. Typically 3 to 5 years. During that period, manufacturers run dual inventory. They're producing some units to the old standard for the domestic market, where retailers haven't cleared old stock, and some units to the new standard for export. This creates what's called a standards overhang, a period of elevated costs that can last a decade or more as the entire supply chain adjusts. Imagine you're a small Israeli manufacturer of electrical fittings. You've got warehouses full of inventory built to the old standard. You've got production lines tooled for the old specifications. You've got contracts with suppliers based on the old requirements. The transition doesn't just mean changing a design. It means writing off assets, retooling, retraining staff, and managing two product lines simultaneously while your cash flow takes a hit.
Even if alignment saves money in the long run, the transition itself is expensive and messy, and the long run might be longer than a lot of small businesses can survive.
Someone bears that cost. The question is, who? Let's look at a real case study. New Zealand. Population 5.1 million, so comparable to Israel in being a small, advanced economy outside a major trading bloc. In the early 2000s, New Zealand entered the Trans-Tasman Mutual Recognition Arrangement with Australia. By 2020, New Zealand had adopted about 80% of Australian standards. Consumer electronics and appliance prices dropped by 4-7% within 5 years. That's real money for households. But it also led to the closure of 3 local testing labs and 120 job losses in the certification sector. The government had to subsidize retraining programs.
There are winners and losers. Consumers win, domestic testing labs lose, and the government ends up writing checks to smooth the transition, which means taxpayers effectively pay twice, once through higher prices under the old system and once through retraining subsidies during the transition.
The food sector tells an even sharper story. New Zealand adopted Australian food standards through FCNZ, Food Standards, Australia, New Zealand. Processed food prices dropped about 6%. But local food testing companies lost 30% of their revenue. 200 certification workers had to be retrained, with government subsidies. The net economic benefit was positive. Consumers saved more than the displaced workers lost, but the distribution was uneven. The savings were spread across millions of households. The losses were concentrated in a few hundred families.
Which is exactly why the SII and its employees fight this so hard. The costs of reform are concentrated and visible. The benefits are diffuse and show up as slightly lower prices on 1,000 different products. That's the classic political economy problem. Dispersed beneficiaries don't organize. Concentrated losers do.
That's the political economy of standards in one sentence. Now let's look at Switzerland, because they've threaded this needle more elegantly than anyone. Switzerland is not in the EU, but it has what's called autonomous adoption of EU standards for most industrial goods. The Swiss standards body, CENV, still exists. It hasn't been abolished. But its role has shifted from developing unique Swiss standards to translating, adapting, and publishing EN standards as Swiss norms. 85% of Swiss standards are identical to European standards. The remaining 15% cover areas where Switzerland has genuine local specificities, things like mountain railway safety, avalanche protection structures, and some food labeling requirements tied to Swiss agricultural policy.
The consumer price impact? Do we have numbers on what Swiss harmonization actually delivered?
Swiss consumer electronics prices are about 12% lower than Israeli equivalents, controlling for VAT differences and general price levels. Part of that is market size and geography. Switzerland is physically embedded in Europe in a way Israel isn't, but a significant chunk is the reduced certification burden. A manufacturer can design one product for the entire European market, including Switzerland, and sell it without modification. There's no Swiss-specific plug, no Swiss-specific safety certification separate from CE marking. The Swiss recognized early on that the cost of maintaining separate standards for commodity consumer goods wasn't buying them any meaningful sovereignty, it was just buying them higher prices.
What's the actual path forward for Israel? The Knesset bill proposes automatic recognition of EU standards for over 200 product categories. How does that compare to what other countries have done?
The most practical model is probably what Norway and Iceland use, conditional recognition. The default rule is that EU standards are automatically accepted unless the national standards body can demonstrate a specific local need within a defined period, typically 90 days. The burden of proof shifts. instead of the SII having to affirmatively adopt each standard, which takes years and creates a massive backlog, the SII has to justify why a particular standard should not be adopted. That flips the default from exclusion to inclusion. It's the difference between prove this European standard is good enough for Israel, and prove this European standard is inadequate for Israel.
The local needs would be things like climate, voltage, language.
Israel's climate is different from Northern Europe. Standards for air conditioning efficiency, for solar water heating. Israel is a world leader in solar thermal, by the way, for building insulation in a Mediterranean climate, for water efficiency and irrigation equipment. These are areas where Israeli standards might legitimately need to diverge from European ones. The SII's strongest argument is in water standards. The SI 92 series on water efficiency is more stringent than EU norms and has been a driver of Israel's drip irrigation innovation. If automatic adoption of EU standards weakened those standards, you could argue it would actually harm Israeli competitiveness in a sector where the country leads globally.
That's the sovereignty argument in its strongest form. Not, we want to protect local manufacturers from competition, but we have developed standards that are better for our conditions and have created export industries around them. That's a much harder argument to dismiss.
And that's why the debate shouldn't be framed as standards versus no standards. It's about whose standards and in which categories. The May 2026 bill actually acknowledges this. It doesn't propose abolishing the SII. It proposes automatic recognition of EU standards for specific product categories where local divergence is hard to justify on safety or performance grounds. Children's car seats, basic construction materials, food contact materials. These are commodity categories where the EU standard is at least as rigorous as the Israeli one, and the cost of divergence falls entirely on consumers.
There's a sunset clause in the bill too, right? I think this is one of the more interesting procedural mechanisms in the proposal.
Yes, and this is clever legislative design. The bill includes a provision that roughly 500 Israeli standards that haven't been updated since 2015 would automatically expire unless the SII can rejustify them. These are standards that have sat unchanged for over a decade, in some cases since the 1990s, while European and international standards have been revised multiple times. If your standard for, say, microwave oven safety hasn't been touched since 1997, and the EU has revised its equivalent standard three times since then with new safety research, your standard is probably not protecting consumers. It's protecting someone's revenue stream. The sunset clause forces the SII to either update these orphan standards or let them die.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. Standards that adjust, taking up space. Nobody remembers why they were written, but removing them requires paperwork.
Standards that exist because they exist. And this is where we need to address a misconception that comes up a lot in this debate. People assume more standards mean safer products. That is not necessarily true. A standard that mandates a unique testing method or a unique form factor doesn't improve safety if the international alternative is equally rigorous. Israel's unique plug standard is not safer than the European Shuko. It's just different. And that difference costs consumers money without producing a safety benefit. The number of standards on the books is not a measure of consumer protection. It's often a measure of regulatory inertia.
Another misconception that the SII is a government agency that the Knesset can simply order around. It's not. And I think this is where a lot of public frustration gets misdirected.
The SII is a non-profit corporation with its own governance structure. Its board includes representatives from manufacturers, importers, consumer groups, and the government. It has significant operational autonomy. The Knesset can pass a law mandating recognition of EU standards, but the SII's technical committees still control the implementation timeline. They can slow walk the translation, raise objections during the comment period, request extensions. The bill creates a legal obligation, but turning that into actual standards on the books requires navigating a process that the SII itself controls. It's a bit like passing a law requiring faster service at the DMV. The law sets the expectation, but the people behind the counter still control the pace.
Which is why Turkey's experience is instructive. Turkey adopted 95% of EN standards as part of its EU Customs Union agreement. That didn't happen because Turkey's standards body voluntarily decided to harmonize. It happened because the Customs Union agreement created a legal framework with deadlines and enforcement mechanisms. Turkish manufacturers now report about 20% lower certification costs for dual EU and domestic market products compared to their Israeli counterparts.
That 20% isn't just an accounting line item. It shows up in retail prices, in export competitiveness, in the willingness of foreign manufacturers to enter the Turkish market. When a European car seat manufacturer looks at Turkey, they see a market where their existing ISO-fixed product can be sold as is. When they look at Israel, they see a market where they need to redesign the anchor mechanism. Guess which market gets more competition? Guess which market has lower prices for parents?
Let's talk about what listeners can actually do with this information. The prompt is asking about the mechanics, but there's a practical angle here too. If someone in Israel is listening to this and thinking, okay, I'm paying $30 more for my toaster, and I'd rather not, what can they actually do?
First, if you're in Israel, you can participate. The SII is legally required to hold public comment periods for proposed standards, and they are legally required to respond to substantive comments. The Ministry of Economy also maintains a regulatory impact assessment database where you can see which standards are under review, the May 2026 bill, Knesset Bill P/25/4567 is public. You can read it, you can contact your Knesset member about it. This is not a closed-door process, even though it feels like one. Most people don't engage with standards policy because it seems technical and boring, but the comment periods are real and the SII does read the submissions.
If you're not in Israel, there's still a lens here for understanding your own cost of living. Look up your country's national standards body. Find out what percentage of its standards are harmonized with international or regional norms versus unique to your country. That number tells you something about how much you're paying for regulatory sovereignty. It's not a perfect proxy, but it's a starting point for understanding why certain products cost more in your market than in the one next door.
The EU's Digital Product Passport Regulation is going to make this even more relevant. Effective 2027, it requires detailed life cycle data, material sourcing, carbon footprint, repairability, for all products sold in Europe. If Israel doesn't align its standards regime with the EU's, Israeli exporters will face a whole new layer of compliance costs. At some point, market forces may make this entire political debate moot. The cost of maintaining separate standards becomes higher than the cost of alignment, and alignment happens not because anyone voted for it, but because the alternative is economic isolation.
The EU is the world's regulatory superpower, setting standards that everyone else eventually adopts because the cost of divergence exceeds the cost of compliance. The Brussels effect.
And Israel's in a particularly tricky position because its economy is deeply integrated with Europe's in high-tech, pharmaceuticals, and agriculture. But its standards regime treats Europe like a foreign market rather than a primary trading partner. The tension between sovereignty and efficiency isn't going away. But the question this bill forces is whether maintaining unique standards for light switches and toasters and car seat anchors is actually an expression of sovereignty or just an expression of inertia.
There's one more angle I want to touch on before we wrap. The SII's defenders make an argument that doesn't get enough airtime in the consumer price debate. If Israel adopts EU standards wholesale, does it lose the ability to innovate its own standards for emerging technologies where it's a world leader? I think this is the most intellectually honest version of the case against harmonization.
This is the strongest counterargument, and it deserves to be taken seriously. Israel's water efficiency standards, the SI92 series, are more stringent than anything in the EU. Those standards didn't emerge from a vacuum. They emerged because Israel faced water scarcity that Northern Europe didn't, developed drip irrigation technology in response, and then codified performance standards that pushed the entire industry forward. Netafim, the Israeli drip irrigation giant, became a global leader partly because domestic standards created a proving ground. If Israel had simply adopted whatever European standards existed for irrigation equipment in the 1970s, that innovation pathway might not have existed. The domestic market wouldn't have demanded the performance levels that eventually became Israel's export advantage.
The question is whether the categories covered by the May 2026 bill are the right ones. Electrical plugs and car seat anchors don't seem like innovation platforms. Water efficiency standards might be. The bill isn't arguing that Israel should abandon standards setting entirely. It's arguing for triage.
That's exactly the distinction the bill tries to draw. 200-plus product categories where local divergence is hard to justify, while leaving room for Israel to maintain and develop its own standards in areas of genuine comparative advantage. The SII doesn't have to disappear. It just has to focus on where it adds value rather than duplicating work that 27 European countries have already done. In water technology, in desert agriculture, in cybersecurity for critical infrastructure, these are areas where Israeli conditions and Israeli expertise might legitimately produce standards that are ahead of the European curve. In toasters and light switches? Not so much.
The toaster in Tel Aviv costs $30 more than the same toaster in Berlin. Whose fault is that?
It's not one actor's fault. It's the accumulated result of decades of institutional inertia, a standards body with a mandate to create Israeli standards rather than to minimize trade barriers. A political system where the beneficiaries of protectionism are concentrated and organized, while the beneficiaries of reform are diffuse and disorganized. And a genuine, if sometimes overstated, belief that Israeli conditions require Israeli solutions. The May 2026 bill is the first serious attempt in years to change the default setting from divergence to alignment. Whether it survives the committee process is an open question. But the fact that it's being debated at all suggests that the cost of the status quo, measured in toasters, car seats, and household budgets, is finally becoming visible enough to mobilize political attention.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1780s, a British naval surgeon stationed in the Gilbert Islands, present-day Kiribati, recorded that local navigators used katabatic wind patterns, the dense cold air sliding down from volcanic peaks at dusk, as a reliable directional cue for nighttime canoe travel between atolls. His journal is the only surviving Western account of this specific navigational technique before it was lost to colonial disruption.
A naval surgeon moonlighting as an amateur meteorologist in Kiribati. It's remarkable how much knowledge disappears when the people who hold it are displaced. Not unlike what happens to institutional knowledge when you overhaul a standards regime, actually.
I have questions about his sample size, but okay. And I appreciate you tying the fun fact back to the theme. That's a stretch, but I'll allow it.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, we're at My Weird Prompts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.